Welcome to this 23rd edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 11th chapter, part 1, titled Becoming Human in the Cosmos. Chapter 11, Becoming Human in the Cosmos. Quote, "Oh, how difficult it is, to become a human being. Even if you have survived the front and bombing and been blown up by landmines, that's still only the very beginning of heroism. That is still not the whole thing." End quote. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, previously cited, page 367. Quote, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, New Testament. Quote, "Let us go on unto perfection." Hebrews chapter 1, verse 6, New Testament. Both of those quotes were from Paul. "The picture of judgment day, when we all stand before God to be judged according to our works, is a recurrent, if not iconic, cartoon theme, where some poor sinner is standing before a podium occupied by a huge bearded figure who, with a quill pen, is going over a large book. All are surrounded by billowing clouds. The theme of Judgment Day is so common in the scriptures that I find at least 30 references to it in the Bible alone. Typical is this one from Revelations, quote, "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works." End quote. For what will we be judged? Well, yes, our works. But what are our works supposed to be? What will the result of this judgment be? Should we be concerned about it and factor it into our decision-making processes? Dr. Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, sums up this meeting. Quote, "The being almost immediately directs a certain thought to the person. Among the translations I have heard are you prepared to die? Are you ready to die? What have you done with your life to show me? And what have you done with your life that is sufficient?" Pages 60 through 61. Moody goes on to clarify that these questions aren't asked accusingly or threateningly. Quote, "The point of the question seems to be to make them think about their lives, to draw them out. It's plain that the questioner isn't concerned with our monthly take-home pay or how many strokes we've taken off our golf game." Dr. Kenneth Ring, previously cited, details this life review in his book, page 155. Quote, "Life reviews teach, and despite the enormous diversity of the images they contain, which is astonishingly universal, they teach us unmistakably, in my judgment, how we are to live. There are certain values, universal values, we are meant to live by, and life review episodes contain vivid and incredibly powerful reminders of these values." Alexander Solzhenitsyn offers insight into dealing with our shadow reality versus the true reality of our spiritual lives. Caught up in the state torture and interrogation apparatus, he asks how one can stand one's ground when, quote, "you are weak and sensitive to pain, when people you love are still alive, when you are unprepared." The answer he gives, "Only my spirit and my conscience remain precious and important to me," end quote. Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, page 130. "Only my spirit and conscience remain precious and important to me. When we inevitably die, what will we take back to God?" Numerous, indeed thousands, of near-death experiences tell us that is exactly what we take back with us to God. Our spirit body, very much alive, indeed more so than the mortal body ever was, carries its mortal experiences back to that being of light at the end of the tunnel, who refreshes our memories with a life review. All we have ever done to develop our souls in this life is carried with us, be it good or evil. We leave behind the new car, the country club membership, the summer cottage. None of these things can possibly impress a God who creates cosmoses, probably on a daily basis. And if we have been less than moral, or in other words, didn't seek to develop our souls while accumulating these things, he not only will not be impressed, but will be unhappy. We will have wasted that gift of life he gave us, the opportunity to develop our souls. This indeed is our major stewardship here, and from almost every near-death account I read, will be the only question on the final exam. My personal feeling is that we'll be judged in the context of the development of our soul. That's why I started this book with Solzhenitsyn's quote, on the purpose of this life being the development of the soul, and why that is ultimately the central theme of this book, and I feel should be the central focus of our lives. Yes, the scripture says we'll be judged according to our works, but our works are the reflection of the development of our souls. Indeed, I feel our major work is the development of our soul. What have we done with the life and the agency, the means God gave us in the beginning? A quick quote, as mentioned earlier, sorry, no attribution. Our life is the gift of God to us. What we do with it is our gift to him. In that context, let's start this final chapter with the most appropriate poem from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, What the Heart of the Young Man Said to the Psalmist. Tell me not in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not dumb, driven cattle. Be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act in the glorious present, heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing, leave behind us footsteps on the sands of time. Footsteps that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing, shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing, with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. There is Judgment Day, and there are many judgments between now and then. We mentioned in an earlier chapter how those having near-death experiences have what seems to be a mandatory life review. I think that these preceding judgments are preparatory to the final one, and that they give us a preview of what will be asked of us at that time. Dr. Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, previously cited, gives us the gist of the life review question. Are you prepared to die? Are you ready to die? What have you done with your life to show me? And what have you done with your life that is sufficient? Pages 60 through 61. These all imply that we are supposed to do something with our lives, and I think that something is more than just exist. There is an attitude behind this question, Quote, "This question, ultimate and profound as it may be in its emotional impact, is not at all asked in condemnation. The being, all seem to agree, does not direct the question to them to accuse or to threaten them, for they still feel the total love and acceptance coming from the light, no matter what their answer may be. Rather, the point of the question seems to be to make them think about their lives, to draw them out. It is, if you will, a Socratic question, one asked not to acquire information, but to help the person who is being asked to proceed along the path to the truth by himself." Page 61 through 62. Quote, "There is never any condemnation. You are not judged. You are in the presence of a being who loves you unconditionally. You are treated with total compassion. You are already forgiven. You are only asked to look at your life and to understand." End quote. Dr. Kenneth Ring, Lessons from the Light. What we can learn from the near-death experience. Page 164. Dr. Kenneth Ring has in the book quoted above an excellent section on this life review. I quote here some of the wisdom offered by Dr. Ring, covering pages 147 through 185. He recommends to those of us who haven't had a near-death experience that we learn from the life reviews of those who have. Quote, "In my opinion, no feature of the near-death experience is more important as a guide to daily life for those who have not had a near-death experience than the life review." Page 147. He writes that despite the great differences in the lives under review, the lessons are basically the same for all. Quote, "They teach us how we are to live. It's as simple as that. There are certain values, universal values, we are meant to live by, and life review episodes contain vivid and incredibly powerful reminders of these values." Page 155. The basic question to all: what had I done to benefit or advance the human race? This person adds, "What I had counted in life as unimportant was my salvation, and what I thought was important was nil." The life review introduces to us or reinforces our connectedness to all living things. All previous filters that may have screened you off from yourself and others are removed. There are no longer any barriers to your understanding. There is no real separation between you and others, and your illusory isolation as an individual in this world is revealed to be a sham. It never was real. You see immediately that rather than having lived apart from others, you are always truly a part of them, and they are a part of you. Page 175. Quote, "If we think we can hurt another person or another living thing without hurting ourselves, we are sadly mistaken." Page 177. The point with Dr. Ring, if I understand him correctly, is for us non-death experienced people to learn from these experiences. I fall into that non-death experience class myself. I've never had one. "The world will not change, however, until we do, and change must therefore start from the ground zero of the self before it can begin to spread. The result is a kind of forgiveness of oneself and others that returns you to your authentic self." Page 178. He proposes a nightly exercise as we settle in for sleep by going over our day's actions and asking ourselves, how would we like to view these things in our life review? At the end of your day, begin to review the events of your day as they actually happened. When you come to a scene that jars you because of events or encounters that still rankle, consider it more closely and ask yourself the question, from the perspective of the life review, how might I have acted or responded? Let the new revised version of this scene now play out in your mind. Do not judge yourself. Just watch it unfold. After taking it in, release the original actual version from your mind and then continue to Review Your Day, page 184. He writes of one of his correspondents, quote, Judy had consciously used her knowledge of the life review to behave as she would have wished to see herself in her own life review, page 183. His point is, as I see it, that we don't all need a near-death experience to have great changes in our lives. We can all benefit from a belief in the knowledge of a true and wonderful continuation of life, and by taking to heart the lessons of the life review. He lists those lessons, page 26. Number one, there is a reason for everything that happens. Number two, find your own purpose in life. See chapter 3 in the book. Number three, do not be a slave to time. Number four, appreciate things for what they are, not for what they can give you. Number five, do not allow yourself to be dominated by the thoughts or expectations of others. Number six, do not be concerned with what others think of you either. Number seven, remember you are not your body. Number eight, fear not, even pain and certainly not death. Number nine, be open to life and live it to its fullest. Number 10, money and material things are not particularly important in the scheme of things. Number 11, helping others is what counts in life. Number 12, do not trouble yourself with competition, just enjoy the show. George Ritchie adds, previously cited, page 52, quote, it seemed to be a question about values, not facts. What did you accomplish with the precious time you were allotted? Hadn't I done anything lasting, anything important? Even as he reviews the good intentions of his mortality, an active Sunday school life, a desire to be a doctor and heal others, he is aware of the shallow motives that taint these otherwise good pursuits, the self-righteousness of being more active in church than others, the desire to drive a fine car and have an airplane from a doctor's salary. Me, 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 always in the center. Wasn't there any time in my life when I had let someone else stand there? Further light on this attitude comes from Lindahl and Widdowson, The Eternal Journey, previously cited, page 51 through 52. Quote, the question to near-death experiencers is usually phrased, what have you done to benefit or advance the human race? Or, what have you done with your life? They quote Betty Eady as learning, quote, that whatever we become here in mortality is meaningless unless it is done for the benefit of others. Our gifts and talents are given to us to help serve, and in serving others, we develop and grow spiritually. In all near-death experiences, this judgment is described as non-judgmental. So where does the judging come in? Apparently, we judge ourselves. In Memories of God and Creation, previously cited, that life review and judgment is described thus, quote, God does not judge or punish anybody. It is we who do so. In heaven, while reviewing our lives, we judge ourselves after realizing the damage we have done to others during a lifetime by our wrongdoings. We are our own harshest judge and jury, and it is we who plan to resolve our negative actions in future lives. We have to balance our negative actions by going through sufferings similar to those we have inflicted on others. It is not God who decides the punishment. We make that decision to correct our negative actions. Page 21. Consider in these words also the implications for reincarnation. Many of us confuse activity for purpose, motion for progress. It is not enough to have a busy life. We must evaluate whether our busyness is developing our souls or just killing the time that would otherwise lay heavy on our hands. In Eric Hoffer's book, The Ordeal of Change, it is written, quote, the individual's most vital need is to prove his worth, and this usually means an insatiable hunger for action. For it is only the few who can acquire a sense of worth by developing and employing their capacities and talents. The majority prove their worth by keeping busy. A busy life is the nearest thing to a purposeful life. End quote, page 30. Hoffer himself worked as a longshoreman, his body earning his income, while his mind explored the world and the doings of men and history. His money went for a small apartment, a few physical necessities, books, and the time to write down his thoughts, which became a series of great and classic books in the 1950s. Few of us have a career that is rewarding in terms of soul development and talent realization. Most of us take a job because we have bills to pay. I've had it both ways, and it is not to compare. It's the difference between eating at the finest restaurant in town and scrounging a meal out of the dumpster behind it. But life, as I have mentioned, hands us these tests and asks us what we'll do with them. I feel at this point that I've been responsible and done what I had to do, but not to the point of totally burying my dreams and talents. I may not make any kind of a mark in this mortal world, but at least I can tell God at my life's review that I didn't quit. I didn't roll over and play dead. This podcast is proof of that. Hoffer makes other interesting observations. When we lose what we might see as our primary purpose in life, as I mentioned for myself above, loss of self-respect usually accompanies it, and I'll have to admit to a bit of that as well. It's a well-known phenomenon among men especially who are defined by their careers that when they lose their jobs, they have tremendously difficult battles with an accompanying loss of self-respect and direction. Hoffer notes, quote, "The unattainability of self-respect has other grave consequences. In man's life, the lack of an essential component usually leads to the adoption of a substitute. The substitute is usually embraced with vehemence and extremism, for we have to convince ourselves that what we took as a second choice is the best there ever was. Thus, blind faith is to a considerable extent a substitute for the lost faith in ourselves, insatiable desire a substitute for hope, accumulation a substitute for growth, fervent hustling a substitute for purposeful action, and pride a substitute for unattainable self-respect." Page 94. Those of us who have lost our primary purpose and goal in life need to look long and hard into the mirror of our souls and ask ourselves if we're fooling ourselves via the means of extremism, blind faith, insatiable desire, accumulation, hustling, and pride. If these elements are in our lives, they are detrimental to the development of our souls, but can we, should we, go back? Hoffer again, quote, "It behooves us to remember that man's only legitimate end in life is to finish God's work, to bring to full growth the capacities and talents implanted in us." Page 95. Alan Watts deals also with the distractions of this life in The Wisdom of Insecurity, A Message for an Age of Anxiety. The 50s philosopher writes, quote, "Consequently, our age is one of frustration, anxiety, agitation, and addiction to dope. Somehow we must grab what we can while we can and drown out the realization that the whole thing is futile and meaningless. This dope we call our high standard of living, a violent and complex stimulation of the senses which makes them progressively less sensitive and thus in need of yet more violent stimulation." So he's not just talking street drugs here. He's talking activities which may not be in our best interests. "We crave distraction, a panorama of sights, sounds, thrills, and titillation, into which as much as possible must be crowded in the shortest possible time." Page 21. He wrote that in 1951. One wonders what he'd think if he could see our 21st century. Same with Eric Hoffer. As the old saying goes, the more things change, the more they remain the same. I think learning to deal with these distractions or decoys to our eternal responsibilities is something each generation has to struggle with, and there will be no changes in this as the generations pass. Just as each senior class of high school students must pass certain requirements, and those never change either. And another philosophic view along these lines from Will Durant, The Pleasures of Philosophy, previously cited, pages 139 through 140. Quote, "Behold, in consequence, the parasitic woman, freed from domestic toil by the withdrawal of industry from the home, and freed from the burden of motherhood by contraceptives or nurses and maids, she is left with hands, head, and heart restlessly idle. The less she has to do, the lazier she becomes, and the less willing she is to perform what remains of the work which once made her a helpmeet instead of a doll." No insult is offered here to the woman who works at home or in the shop as producer of human life or of humanly valuable goods. The insult is offered, for what it may be worth, to the woman who commercializes her beauty, in marriage or without, who drives hard bargains in luxury and finery for her love, who spends her days in resting, primping, powdering, curling, and at last dressing, and her nights in amusement and flirtation. In all the varied panorama of modern life, there is nothing so offensive as the expensive idleness of these women. They have few children or none, but they need many servants. Think in terms of entourage or peeps, Cosmos author. They have no function, but they have endless needs. They specialize in the art of doing nothing in a thousand fancy ways. End quote. Like Hoffer and Watts, Durant also wrote in the 50s, yes, Yogi, it's deja vu all over again. And how quickly they come and go. A decade ago it was Paris Hilton. Now she's faded from the scene, thank God, and has been replaced by the Kardashians, who are currently being replaced, I guess. I don't really follow these things closely, but please, God, let something replace them. And a note quickly in passing, Durant's observation of, quote, "she is left with hands, head, and heart restlessly idle." This fits nicely with Chapter 7's observations of the four parts of the human being and the need we have to develop and grow in all four of these areas. In a previous chapter, we discussed how complex the cosmos really is, how an incredible amount of experimentation and trial and error was required to get it right, and how Earth is in a Goldilocks zone, in an extremely narrow balance of just right, so life could begin and thrive. I think this complexity is mirrored in our own lives as we try to develop them for our eternal and infinite purposes. It simply is not simple. In restaurants with my kids, I used to play games while waiting for our food to come to keep them busy and entertained. One frequent game was to take one of their crayons that came with a kiddie meal, set it upright on the blunt end, and try and balance a spoon on it. It takes a lot of delicate care and manipulation to keep the crayon upright and get the spoon on it in just the right place. So it is with the cosmos. So it is with our lives. And of course, when I got the spoon balanced, the kids enjoyed banging on the table and making it fall. Such is life. Differences in specific tasks to accomplish here abound. Some come here to develop talents or overcome weaknesses and difficulties, others to form families and help others, but we all have these assignments in common. From The Eternal Journey, previously cited, page 70, quote, "I realized that there are things that every person is sent to Earth to realize and to learn. For instance, to share more love, to be more loving toward one another, to discover that the most important thing is human relationships and love and not materialistic things." A guardian angel told Ingrid during her near-death experience that the reason it is difficult for humans and angels to work together is that humans give too much thought to the material things of Earth and too little thought to the everlasting virtues and truths. Betty Eady saw how damaging the lust for things in the world is. She said all real growth occurs spiritually, and worldly things like possessions and rampant appetites smother the spirit. Howard Storm puts this into focus with his observations on his life and how he'd blown off his family and the opportunities to love them because of his career priorities. My Descent into Death, previously cited, pages 34 through 35. Quote, "It was amazing to see that God had chosen a woman to love me and for me to love her. God brought my wife and me together to learn to love. God had given us the opportunity to learn love by having children and raising them to be loving. The most unloving thing that I did was to be at times so obsessed with my concerns that I was indifferent to their needs. The emotional abandonment of my children was devastating to review." End quote. In his life review in his near-death experience, "It was horrifying to see how I had put my status and success above everything else. I was caught dangling on the strings others pulled, missing the simple love and joy of wife and family." Quote, "God is love." End quote. 1 John chapter 4, verse 8, New Testament. 3 words, 9 letters. Thus the whole cosmos is summed up in the simplest form possible. God is the personification of love. If we are to become one with Him, be like Him in every respect, then we must become love too. Let's quote these 3 verses to get the entire context from which this quote is pulled. 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 through 9. Quote, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. In this was manifested the love of God toward us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him." 3 verses, and love, or a form of the word, for example, beloved, is mentioned 7 times. It is my belief that when God wants us to get a certain point, he emphasizes it several times in a short space. The nearly universal observation of the near-death experience is the overwhelming love felt in the presence of the being of light, a non-judgmental, non-condemnatory love that can hardly be borne. George Ritchie finishes his book, Return from Tomorrow, previously cited, page 124, with this paragraph, quote, "God is busy building a race of men who know how to love. I believe that the fate of the earth itself depends on the progress we make, and that the time now is very short. As for what we'll find in the next world, here, too, I believe that what we'll discover there depends on how well we get on with the business of loving here and now." Lindahl and Whittison, previously cited, The Eternal Journey, also conclude their book with these comments on the importance of love, pages 268 through 271, quote, "Most important in life and death is love. If there is a single message that characterizes the near-death experience, it is love. It fills the next world and engulfs those who go there and experiencing it. Near-death experiencers feel the most important message they bring back with them is that we should love everybody with unconditional love. What really counts is what you did for others, how much you loved beyond yourself, how much you really loved, and how well. The key to growth in the future is to love ourselves and to extend that love to others. The interconnectedness of all living things and the love we feel for all life are gifts from God." End quote. Dennis Prager, quoted earlier, mentioned that it can be hard at times to love God. I think of Job in this context from the Old Testament. When God permitted Satan to throw everything he could at Job, with the exception of taking away his life, and when Job, who had been prosperous, respected, and had a large family, wound up sitting on the city dump scraping his skin sores with a broken piece of pottery, Job said, "The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job chapter 1, verse 21. We can all say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," when the Lord giveth. Can we say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," when he taketh away? That's the hard part. Yet learning to love God is the first commandment, and learning to love him under all circumstances is the only way to keep that commandment. It's a toss-up as to which is harder, learning to love God at all times and under all conditions, or learning to love our fellow humans under the same circumstances. But we must consider that learning to love implies that it is not an inherited skill. It doesn't come automatically. For the most part, we love those who love us and treat us nice, but that is an incomplete love. It is no more the total package of love we want to take back to that being at the end of the tunnel of light than we'd want to take a sixth grade education into a hospital review hiring board and apply for the position of head surgeon. Of course, we're all at different stages or degrees of learning this most important eternal skill. Mother Teresa, for example, was as advanced in this as probably any person alive. Others have at best just the beginning smoldering embers, and may have those stamped out if they're born into an abusive family environment. The near-death experience of Virginia Rivers, as quoted in They Saw Beyond Death, previously cited, page 323, says, quote, "I remember only two things from that exchange with God. First, God told me there were only two things that we could bring back with us when we died, love and knowledge. So I was to learn as much about both as possible. This shows us that love is something we need to learn and not just grow into or have automatically. It is an acquired skill. We must be proactive in the acquisition of this quality." This is affirmed in Moody's Life After Life, page 65, quote, "The being in the light seems to stress the importance of two things in life, learning to love other people and acquiring knowledge." In a life review with the being in the light, Moody previously cited, page 67, a woman is shown each year of her life, and certain instances are pointed out with special emphasis placed on where the participant had shown love. Quote, "All through this, he kept stressing the importance of love. He pointed out to me that I should try to do things for other people, to try my best. He seemed very interested in things concerning knowledge, too. He kept on pointing out things that had to do with learning, and he did say that I was going to continue learning." Mormon prophet Brigham Young, for whom the LDS University is named, said much on mainly self-education. Here are some selected quotes of his from the Journal of Discourses, previously cited. Quote, "We have the privilege of becoming classical scholars, of commencing at the rudiments of all knowledge, we might say, of perfection. We might study and add knowledge to knowledge, from the time that we are capable of knowing anything until we go down to the grave. There is no end to man's learning. We are made expressly to dwell with those who continue to learn. The greatest and most important labor we have to perform is to cultivate ourselves." It was Brigham Young who said regarding education, "If you educate a man, you educate an individual. If you educate a woman, you educate a family." He taught his people, and I think this applies to all, every accomplishment, every polished grace, every useful attainment in mathematics, music, and in all science and art belong to the saints. Author's note, I would broaden that to include all of mankind. And they should avail themselves as expeditiously as possible of the wealth of knowledge the sciences offer to every diligent and persevering scholar. That in a day when evolution from Darwin and the time differences between science and religion were becoming greatly pronounced. quote, "We should cease to be children and become philosophers, understanding our own existence, its purpose, and ultimate design. Then our days will not become blank through ignorance." It's a proverb that we can't take it with us, but these two things, love and knowledge, are apparently the exception to that rule. But what kind of love? What kind of knowledge? A love for material things has been dealt with in the previous chapter. It is the love for God and our fellow beings based on a love for ourselves that God refers to in his two great commandments. In chapter 7, we discussed the four aspects of human nature as set forth in the first commandment, to love God with all our heart, might, mind, and strength. If learning to love is one of the two great tasks we each face here in mortality, then we might profit from examining love in this light. The second commandment tells us to love our neighbor as ourselves. This implies we must love ourselves, or we have nothing to give, no footing on which to secure ourselves as we try to love those who sometimes are unlovable. We focus much on the love Jesus had for everyone, and rightly so, but did he love himself? In terms of the physical, he is on record as both fasting for 40 days and enjoying feasts and suppers with friends. Since he walked nearly everywhere except for that final donkey ride into Jerusalem, he must have been in excellent physical shape. Most people in those days of foot transportation were, so Jesus had no particular need of a physical regimen as we do today. As to loving his mental aspect, books were hard to come by. There were libraries such as those at Alexandria, but he had no access to that. The only book most common people ever saw was the Torah in the synagogue, which Jesus knew well as he quoted it often. I think, though, in his excellent and instructive use of parables, Jesus obviously learned from nature's book as it unfolded around him. He was able to use his observations of fishermen, rich men, shepherds, and farmers, as well as sparrows and lilies, to put together simple yet powerful parables that gave his disciples much insight into the kingdom of God. He showed a willingness to learn in questioning the priest in the temple when he was 12, and showed us that formal education isn't the only way to become an observant, educated person. There's no question as to him spiritually loving himself. Many is the record of his going into the desert to commune with God or praying to God with his disciples. As to the social aspect of his life, it is in the record that he enjoyed the company of his disciples at meals and walking and talking with them. The family of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were close friends of his, and he apparently went to their home often. The point is, as we consider learning to love, we must start with the basic foundation of learning to love ourselves in a proper manner, as Jesus loved himself. Much is said in theology against self-love, how selfishness is destructive and not in accord with the Christian or religious life. This is true when self-love becomes destructive or abusive, such as always putting one's physical wants and desires over those of others. But there's no record of Jesus doing this. I think it's like the airplane depressurization angle mentioned earlier. When the oxygen masks dangle down in front of you, put yours on first, so you can have the clear head you'll need to place the mask on your struggling child. As we face the task of learning to love, we must dispassionately assess via a look into the mirror of our souls as to whether we love ourselves, not as to whether we're willing to indulge our every physical whim at the expense of others, but whether, in a balanced and wise way, we care for our own heart, might, mind, and strength, in approximately the same manner Christ cared for his. This is not just a starting point. It is a place we'll need to come back to time and again as we refill our reservoirs of love when the needs of others have drained them off. We are finite vessels and can only pour out so much before needing a refill. Our task in learning to love is to pour out to the extent of our capacity, then refill and stretch that capacity as best we can. Christ, pouring from infinite capacity, still had need to refill by communing with his Father, refreshing himself with family, friends, and disciples, and increasing his store of knowledge by observations and meditations on the book of nature and the world around him. Many women who usually wind up in demanding caregiving positions, tending children, an elderly parent, or perhaps an ill family member, can be run ragged with the neediness and demands of those they are helping. I like to say I'm good with kids for about 10 minutes. Then I begin to take on a hunted aspect. A mother has to deal with them pretty much 24/7. Husbands, fathers, are you listening? Give her a break, often. Besides, your kids need to connect with you, too. A popular question for these people is, who is going to care for the caregiver? A good answer to that question must be found and implemented, lest the caregiver run dry of resources and begin to feel drained and incapacitated. Yes, give her a break. I say this without hypocrisy. I have changed many diapers. And when the baby is changed and all clean and sweet-smelling, put your mouth on their warm, round little tummies and blow hard, giving them a raspberry. It will send them off screaming and giggling with delight, and they'll look forward to changing sessions with Dad, as will Mom, who, I guarantee, needs the break. And thus we conclude this 23rd podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled Chapter 11, Part 2, and will deal with Becoming Human in the Cosmos, continued. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's HAZELLEPRODUCTIONS.COM. And thank you.